I am thrilled with today's guest, Alyssa Farah Griffin. She is, of course, the co-host of The View, a CNN political commentator. Her background is incredible. She was press secretary. I mean, she was White House Director of Strategic Communications, assistant to the president in 2020 during Donald Trump's end of his presidency. She was press secretary to U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and special assistant to President Donald Trump from October 17th till September 19th. And in 2019, she was appointed as the youngest press secretary of the Pentagon in history. She is the only person to have served as the top spokesperson for the president, the vice president, and the secretary of defense. And it's our pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for being here, Liz. I'm such a big fan. You've become a really important voice out there because of your various lives that you've had. And so congratulations on all your success.
Well, thank you. And thank you for having me. I'm a huge fan of yours. And it was such a pleasure when we got to have you on The View a couple months back. So please do join us anytime. Your voice is very important.
Yeah, you guys did it. You know, it's interesting. So many, particularly major networks, basic, you know, whether it's an NBC, ABC, CBS, daytime shows, you know, more mass, were afraid to tackle anti-Semitism. You know, as bizarre as that is, you guys were like very brave. And I understand from the producers, there was a lot of back and forth because, and therein lies the essence of the problem, what's going on today for the whole conflict, in that people who are so upset about the innocent Palestinians being killed, you can't even recognize that the Jews are the anti-Semitism that's having a problem in the States here. And like, if somehow a network does that, they're betraying those other younger, more woke people. It's a crazy time we're in right now.
Well, and honestly, you were one of the first people kind of making this point that people, Americans, people around the globe need to be able to hold two collective thoughts at once. My heart genuinely breaks for innocent Palestinians caught in the crossfire of this. I also fundamentally care about the Israeli hostages who are suffering. I fundamentally care about Israelis in the United, or Jews in the United States who are facing anti-Semitism. And we're going to be just as quick, people like you and I, to call out Islamophobia when it exists in our country. Amen. But you can't not tell those stories and shy away from it.
Here's the thing that I haven't said this yet. I'm going to say it on the air next time. I'm actually on Morning Joe tomorrow. Everybody, the place that everybody has landed on is interesting. Because most people, if you're a sane person, you see two sides to it. You go, look, what's happening to the Palestinians is unacceptable. It's got to change. You can't have all these dead babies. Yet on the other hand, Israel has a right to and needs to finish off Hamas. Those two things don't go in the same sentence. Yet that's kind of what everybody's saying. And they mean it meaning well. Like, well, of course, you have to. You can't leave 8,000 or 10,000 terrorists in place. Yet they go, well, the cost of getting those terrorists, how many more lives, and what does that do to Israel's standing? And nobody's saying we're in a Rubik's Cube right now. We are in an absolute fucking Rubik's Cube.
Well, and by the way, for people, especially young people calling for a ceasefire, I don't think there's a living person who doesn't want to see hostilities cease. Yes. But any call for a ceasefire needs to first start with releasing the hostages. You still have people who we don't even know how many are still alive. Right. But it also seems like it's forgotten that Israel's come to the table twice on ceasefires, and it's been Hamas that's rejected them. And I actually recently read that the English translation of Hamas's charter in Article 13 explicitly states that Hamas rejects peace negotiations. Yeah. That is part of their stated mission. They say it runs counter to Islamic jihad. And we need to know the enemy we work with.
That's interesting. So I say that again. I'm just learning that. That's an amazing stat.
Hamas's own charter, if you look at Article 13, it says that they do not support negotiated peaces. And they reject international conferences to try to establish peace because they see it is in contradiction of Islamic resistance.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. What else do you need to know? What else do you need to know?
Yeah.
So you have had such an incredible career at a very young age. I'm not going to say it here. I read your age. I can't believe you're like 12. I mean, it's just incredible. how did you get at such a young age in such a glaring light of the center stage? I mean, you in your early 20s were in really, really an important conservative voice out there.
Well, a wild part of my bio that you didn't get to was I was actually the first House Freedom Caucus spokeswoman.
Wow, okay.
And I tell that because it's not only instrumental in the roles that I was able to get into, it also gives me an insight into so much of what's wrong with the Republican Party right now. So I was there in the early days. It was Jim Jordan. It was Mark Meadows. There were these backbenchers who basically wanted to use the power of the minority within a majority of the House Republican conference to try to get more conservative policy solutions. When I think of the fights we picked back in those days, Obama was president. It was a lot about like holding his administration accountable, holding our leadership to, you know, try to bring down spending, to try to like rein in the debt.
Like
it was
stuff like that made conservative stuff, just conservative
stuff that made sense. Yeah. And there were a few things that I disagree on looking back. Like they tried to block TPP, the Transatlantic Pacific, Trans-Pacific Partnership. But there was a substance and a policy and a like conservative coherence there. And to see it and just basically 10 years, it morphed into the PR arm of Donald Trump, an organization that is actually helping the Kremlin right now by blocking aid to Ukraine and basically wasting taxpayer dollars every day with just ongoing investigations that are going functionally nowhere. Regardless of what you think of like the Biden investigations, you're not impeaching him. There's a presidential election ahead. Nothing has risen to those levels. And it's just stunning and kind of a snapshot of a lot of what's wrong on the right now.
Well, you had a front row seat. You are the only person I know of, actually, that has been on record as saying firsthand, Donald Trump said to you, he knew he lost the election. You were watching TV, and he said to you, I think the exact words, I can't believe I lost to that guy. And what's amazing is that can be said, and it just falls on deaf ears. If you like, it doesn't, no, either she's making it up, or he didn't say that, or he was kidding. We're in this other solar system now that is just insane.
It's unbelievable. And he came after me after I said that the first time, not thinking much of it. He literally was looking at his television. Fox News was on. He often would watch TV and then he'd like pause it and rewind, which is the most bizarre way to consume news. You're going to miss some things. And he says, can you believe I lost to this fucking guy?
Right.
Pointing to Biden. And there are countless other people who've come forward and said he knew he lost. I believe he knows deep down.
Yes.
I think that he's just lacks the character to accept defeat. I thought Biden had a smart line about that in the State of the Union. And I actually noticed George Bush had a great line when Joe Lieberman passed about his grace and dignity in both loss and in victory, which was very pointed at Trump, obviously. Somebody who cannot accept defeat.
So I would guess your come to Jesus moment was on January 6th when you wrote, you tweeted out, Dear MAGA, I am one of you. Before I worked for Donald Trump, I worked for Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan, the Freedom Caucus. I marched in 2010 Tea Party rallies. I campaigned with Trump and voted for him, but you need to hear me. The election was not stolen. We lost.
So for me, it was a bit of time coming. So I actually resigned in early December. I knew that he lost as soon as the race was called. The results actually very closely modeled the own Trump campaign projections. And I was uncomfortable with the lies that were being espoused and did not want to put my name to them. I am comfortable defending anything I've ever said around Trump, but I did not want to put my name to something that was just an explicit lie. I never thought it would go as far as it did, though. Like what I had left, I was living down in Florida for a period when January 6th happened. And like the day before, I talked to Vice President Pence's chief of staff, who I'm close with, and said, you know, are you worried at all? And he's like, it's going to be a tough day. But even he, I don't think, realized like this was going to be a violent, dangerous day that with one different decision could have changed the course of human history. But I'll say this. So I worked in the Trump administration for basically 3 years. So most of the administration and in different roles. My time with explicitly working for Trump was basically April 2020 to when I resigned in December. And there was a brief moment. You've known Trump over the years.
I knew him for 20 years,
There's this weird thing that I remind people. I drank the Kool-Aid for about 4 months.
He's a charming guy.
He will charm your pants off. He also, in smaller settings, he can kind of be self-deprecating and he makes it a point to remember certain things about people and make them feel seen and feel special. And so within a couple months, I was like, you know what? I don't like how he talks. I don't like some of the things he says. I don't agree with every policy, but there's something about this guy I just believe in. He's my fighter. Mm-hmm. That all changed for me, actually, after George Floyd's murder. It was something that I think any human being could watch and could see and be like, this is horrific. Your policy position on it after, like what we should do could be different, but that was like a fundamental human reaction. And I saw him watch the video, feel what every person did, but then go on to do everything possible to not de-escalate tensions and actually to ramp them up. And I remember telling my then fiance at the time, I was like, win or lose, I'm leaving after the election. But I'd actually toyed with resigning then. I remember going in, he'd put out that infamous statement, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. And I raced into the Oval, to his dining room off the Oval, and was like, sir, you've got to walk this back. People, you know, you need to say, you need to explain that what you were saying is when there's looting, it could lead to violence and we condemn violence. And that's why the looting needs to stop. He's like, oh, no, no. I meant if they loot, we're going to shoot. And I was like, geez. So it was, I spent a day trying to get him to take it down. I think he was, I think Twitter added a note to it.
How does he how does he deal with when, because we all know, and what he's trying to do this time, there's not going to be any resistance in the White House. We're going to talk about that. How does he deal when people push back?
Not well, but I will say I always try to approach it by reasoning with him on his level.
Yes.
So I would say, you know, this is the press is interpreting it this way and they're going to come for you. You need to explain that's not what you meant. But he won't even take, like most bosses would kind of take that leadership and be like, oh shit, that makes sense. Yeah. He doesn't. I remember once there was some tweet he wanted to put out. We were on Marine One and I was like, this is going to give a story more heat that's not even, you know, getting much. And he's like, yeah, you're right. 2 minutes later, he tweets it out after we walk off the helicopter. But it's some of it's silly as I look back, but then you realize how dead serious it is. Like he lacks the most basic impulse control. I think he's also he's not as sharp as he once was.
No, I've said that. You could see it. I've known him. You could see it. He's his fastball. He's lost a lot off his fastball.
Yeah.
Here's what I keep saying on the air, and people refuse to go there. I don't mean necessarily in the media, although yes, in the media, but people in general. I keep saying you have to understand what's going to happen when he gets elected. You have to, your people are not, when I say to people, do you understand that your child might not vote again or might not vote again that matters? Do you understand that he wants the FCC and the FTC to report to him and that if he doesn't like what MSNBC is doing, he'll call up Brian Roberts and say, I'm going to take apart your empire, that he wants to bring back the Insurrection Act and turn the military on his citizens, that he will go after, just randomly go after people, put them in jail. Like, the things we take so for granted, people can't register that. It's not seeping in. I'll talk to people. We know so many people. I'm not talking about the MAGA crazies. I'm talking about Upper East Side, wealthy people. Mm-hmm. You say, they go, nah, yeah, he's a little crazy, but I'm like, no, you don't understand how dark it can get.
I'm having this conversation constantly. And it's striking to me because I really do try to hold myself accountable to never be hysterical and to never overstate.
Same thing. I even preface it and go, I know everybody's thinking I'm crazy. I'm not. It's in slow motion.
You start to feel crazy. Yeah. And I can honestly say without an ounce of drama, I know for a fact that this will be a deeply dangerous presidency. It will undermine every single institution. It will fundamentally undermine our democracy.
So talking, because people use words like constitution, democracy, that doesn't take it down to a personal, for instance, I believe so, this will happen.
Yeah. So there's kind of two things I focus on the most. So he's already said he's installing loyalists across the board. Now, loyalists don't mean lifelong Republicans like Alyssa Farah
Griffin. You're willing to lie. The first thing they're asking in the RNC interviews is, was the election true?
Explicitly, yes. And top of that, he wants to do this, he used this kind of arcane policy, I guess it's draft legislation he has, to make every federal employee basically a Schedule C, which means you can fire them at will. So what that does is, like, I was a political appointee in the Trump administration. At any moment, without any reason, I could be terminated. We have civil servants who it's incredibly hard to get rid of for precisely the reason that you need subject matter experts. You need nonpartisans. Yes. You need people who are going to challenge who's in power. He wants to do away with that in the entirety of the federal government. I worked at the Pentagon. That's a 20,000 plus person workforce. Imagine if we had a pandemic when you take out all subject matter experts and you put in, frankly, some lunatics like the people he's surrounding himself with. That's dire. You talked very well about the external factors. He's going to weaponize the DOJ. He's going to weaponize, the IRS is honestly the least important.
I'm the least worried about
that's what IRS. I'm the least worried about. Yeah, I do think he'll go after the media. He's said as much. And Biden needs to also be awake to this because Trump used to say that his biggest regret was that he didn't prosecute Hillary Clinton in his first
term. He'll go after Biden.
Biden officials should not think that they're going to be immune and that he's not going to target them systemically. And I really, really worry for the world stage. I think that the best case scenario is that America stops being the leader of the free world because he pulls us out of core alliances. He doesn't come through for allies. But I think there's much more dangerous effects. I believe him when he says he would let Russia invade Europe if our NATO allies aren't paying enough.
I'll take it to the next step. I've said that if Putin gave him $10 billion, he would look the other way, let him do whatever he wants. I mean, literally to that level, you know?
Look at the Saudis. Yeah. We kind of saw it in the first term. I think China as well, this him completely flip-flopping on TikTok shows that he can get bought. There's no core belief that he has.
Purely transactional.
He's purely transactional. And he doesn't get American democracy. He doesn't get America's role in the world stage. He only sees the world as, how does this benefit me?
Yeah. If you look up sociopath in the dictionary, I think he's 8 of 9. Yeah. I mean, like, explicit, you're reading, you're going Trump, 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 Trump. So explain to me, I know you're not a behaviorist, you're not a sociologist, you're not an archaeologist. Explain to me how half this country goes, yes, thumbs up. Thumbs up. Beyond the obvious, there's a core. I understand when your life is so miserable and somebody comes along and says, I'm going to make things the way they were. I'm going to fix everything. It's not your fault. It's the brown person's fault. It's the Jews' fault. It's the media's fault. I understand that. But there's a much bigger swath that is saying, okay, we need this. And young people, 62% of young people think that a dictator might be the way to go. They want to blow up the institution. So what am I missing?
It's a number of factors. It's kind of a confluence of bad factors coming together at once. I think a totally fractured media environment where you have the rise of sort of alternative media, when you've got some of these podcast hosts and these Rumble hosts who are getting audiences bigger than a lot of cable news, but they're not beholden to any sort of factual standards. So there's this massive rise in misinformation where voters are hearing and believing things that just objectively aren't true. But it also allows voters to live in sort of media echo chambers. So this is a wild example, but Mike Pence refusing to endorse Trump is a big fucking deal. Mm-hmm. It got something like three minutes of airtime on Fox.
Yeah, 3 minutes. Yes. 3 or 4 minutes.
So their viewers, a lot of them won't even be aware that that's happening.
Yeah.
They won't take time to think, what does that mean? The man who is closest to him cannot say that he's fit for office. I think that there's just the general polarization of people wear a jersey and they hate the other side. And I think we're in a moment where hate for the other side is more motivating to a lot of people than like even the core beliefs of the team that they're on. And I do think people are being lied to. I mean, most elected Republicans are espousing myths about the election.
Yeah.
They're defending Trump.
70% think it was that Biden actually lost.
Yeah. And when you've got everyone you were told to believe in, congressmen, senators, saying it's a witch hunt, everyone in your party, you're going to start to believe that. Like, I actually have a lot of sympathy and grace for the Trump voter. Most people are like, they're working, they're paying their bills. They don't necessarily have time to follow everything. What is hard for me, though, because January 6th was the ultimate breaking point for me, and I called on him to resign the day after. How Americans forgot about that so quickly and just made their peace with it and decided.
And it's on tape and it's video. Like, in other words, so it's not like a story. I always say when something's on video, it registers. No, you know, there were a few crazy people there. And yeah, Trump should have done something. Like, it's just incredible. I was on Nicole the other day and she was saying, you have to keep running that tape over and over. I'm like, that's great. It doesn't register. We're missing something else. It doesn't register.
It doesn't. I remember talking to Liz Cheney the first time I sat down with the January 6th committee, or before, not the full committee, it was actually just with Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. And I said, you know, I spoke out after January 6th because I felt a duty to, but I also assumed others would follow. And she laughs and she's like, yeah, me too. Like, we didn't have a second thought. It was like, we saw it with our eyes. Of course, everyone is going to come around. And a lot of them briefly, you know, Kevin McCarthy, I'm done with him.
And then he's in my
They just decided, you know, we're going to rewrite history and pretend that that didn't happen and that it wouldn't happen again. And that he won't be deeply more dangerous in a second term. By the way, my prediction, one of his first actions, if God forbid he wins, he will do a mass deportation around the country. Now, you can have any sort of views on illegal immigration, how we should deal with the DACA population, all of that. But I'm talking about rounding up millions of people, tearing them from their homes, tearing them from the only lives they ever knew, and shipping them somewhere with no plan for how they're going to even survive when they get there. I think he's going to want a big win for the base, and he's going to want to show that he's tough. And then it becomes retribution.
We're going to, whether he wins or loses, we're going to enter into a civil war. I believe that. If he loses, it's going to be worse than last time.
Yeah.
I mean, so like I actually, 2 years before January 6th, went on Chris Matthews and said he's going to tell people to take to the streets if he loses. I think I was the first one. It's going to be at a next level. And if he wins and starts to do the things that you're talking about, which I agree with, there's going to be civil unrest and there's going to be people taking the streets on the other side. So I believe either way, we are headed to a real powder keg situation.
Well, and by the way, you said something important, which is this isn't going to be peaceful even if he loses. Why would it be this time? Luckily, he doesn't command the military, but he has a loyalist in Speaker Johnson. He has states rigged with people who are, I don't like to use the word rigged. He has states that he actively recruited people.
Yeah, he didn't have it set up last time. He didn't have it set up.
Correct.
Last time. Yeah.
Who will reject results at the state level, and it will be chaos. And that is going to, there's inevitably going to be turmoil. And I think one thing I do want to say just on the previous question, I've got to be honest though, that I do think Biden is incredibly weak. And that's a factor because every time I talk to Republicans, I'm trying to win over, I say, I'm like, guys, can't you deal with bad policies, what you see as bad policies and somebody who might seem weak over somebody who will literally change what it is to be America? And they keep coming back to it.
I think Americans, I think one of the psychological reasons for that, Americans on some level, we see ourselves as strong and they would vote for strong and evil versus weak and nice. Like I think it's a very weird dynamic. And for some reason, Biden, you say to, they go, what about Biden? I go, well, what about Biden? You start to tick off the things. He's like, yeah, he's old. Yeah. There's no question about it. I mean, he's not perfect. He's not an ideal candidate. But Liz Cheney had it right. I always say to people, we'll get to the other side. And there's a great bench. There's a great bench on both sides, by the way. But we're not going to get to the other side the other way. The other way, there's no fixing it. I said, we'll go through. And by the way, everybody goes, Kamala. Like, even if Kamala gets it, she'll get voted out because she'll lose and we'll get the right Republican candidate in it. So, but it doesn't register.
It's this memory too of like, I opposed a lot of Obama's presidency, but the world still turned, America still thrived. And, you know, we came out on the other side of it. And by the way, Joe Biden's, I would argue, significantly more moderate than someone like a President Obama.
A
like this border
not even,
deal that
not even a
Republicans
question.
Blocked never would have happened.
Yeah, not even a question. So who would have thunk in 2024 we'd be talking about a state like Arizona saying we need an entire ban on abortion, period, end of stop. And that's the bad news. The good news is I think it's the only thing that's going to save the Democrats is I think women are the only thing that's going to save Democrats. I think, look, as you know, well know, and it's well documented, every time it's on a ballot, whether it's Kentucky, Kansas, the most red state, it's a 70% rebuke. But it's amazing we're even here.
It's unbelievable. And by the way, Ronald Reagan believed in exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother. Yeah. If you're starting so extreme that like crazy ass Carrie Lake says it's too extreme, although it's a flip flop, you're off the reservation at that point. It's scary. And I have heard from so many lifelong Republican girlfriends who say, this is not what we wanted. Women who will say, you know, I'm personally pro-life. I have personal convictions, you know, in my church or in my family about this, but we never wanted to see what you're seeing in Texas and Arizona, where the lives of expectant mothers and their future fertility is at risk. And I do think this is the best saving grace that Biden has. They have to be able to message the hell out of it, because this is my warning. The vast majority of Americans are with them on reproductive rights, but they have to every single day tie it to Donald Trump, because CNN did this interview with a woman in Florida who basically said, I'm excited that I'm going to get a chance to vote for Donald Trump, but also vote to uphold reproductive rights.
Yeah, yeah.
Those voters exist.
Yeah.
Some Republicans, as you mentioned, turned out in Ohio, Kansas, and Kentucky.
And Trump's already distanced himself from that. He's, you know, you have to keep
and
bringing it back.
He's a master at that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I expect, and I hate when I put myself in his head, but I know how he thinks a lot. I also expect he's going to start saying, listen, Joe Biden's president right now, and he's not restoring your reproductive rights. Nothing's going to be different after the election.
Yeah.
So this is going to require the Biden team to have the best surrogates all over the country and all the battleground states talking about it constantly. And that this isn't where rights being rolled back stops. It's LGBTQ rights next. It's, you know, name it, and they're going to come for it.
everybody always asks me, because I'm the messaging guy, I'm the branding guy, you know, what should the Democrats do? What would you? I keep coming back to, and I, because the traditional persuasion messages don't work. When you have videotape of January 6th and it doesn't register, when you, you know, put through various things, it doesn't. If we could ever get Millie McMaster, Kelly, and Mattis on camera, black and white, talking to camera and going, look, I don't care whether you're Republican or Democrat. We're not going to survive it. If you're worried about the safety of your children, like those guys have to step. There's nobody else. It's not his ex-cabinet members. It's those rock granite, you know, patriots that I don't care who you are. You go, this is daddy. You know what I mean? And I don't know where else I would go. I don't know where else to go.
I completely agree. I'm very close with former chairman Mark Milley. He's used his voice, but I think seeing a number of them in unison say it, the stakes are so unbelievably high. They know my former boss, Mark Esper, has been very outspoken, but again, he's a political appointee. I think it's
different. It's got to be the generals. There's something about the military that lives in a different place, because at the end of the day, those guys are selfless. They put their lives on the line. All they care about is protecting this country. That's their essence.
And I want to believe they are going to do it at some point, because they know that Donald Trump is going to appoint someone like Kash Patel to oversee the intelligence agencies. This is a person with no serious national security background who promotes conspiracy theories. He would be utterly reckless in any of those roles and could literally end our intelligence gathering abroad and fundamentally just change how we protect our national security. I think of some of the just absolute lunatics he's decided to keep around him, who are the core that are staying with him. By the way, I should mention, he's also going to be smarter in a second term in a lot of ways. He knows how to bypass Senate confirmation. So that was something that, you know, you had people like Chris Christie, you had people like Pence recommending some of these early cabinet officials. So you got some decent people in there. But he also learned that you can appoint somebody to a deputy secretary level or right beneath, and they can be appointed in an act. They could be moved up in an acting capacity to oversee an agency like DOD without going through Senate approval. So it can only be for a short period of time. I believe it's 150 days, but you can do a lot in that period. He's planning all of this. He knows how it works now. He knows how to better work the system in his favor.
I'm really worried. I think if the election today, Trump would win in a landslide, actually. A lot can happen between now and then. I also believe we're going to see twists and turns we haven't anticipated. I don't know what that means, I go back to the Hillary thing. There was passion for Hillary and passion against Hillary. There was passion against Trump, but passion for Trump. Same thing with Biden. It's passion against him. There's no passion for him. And I always go to the passion enthusiasm thing. And I look at these numbers, forget head to head. It doesn't matter. You look at what's happening with non-white voters, with young voters, and with independent voters. And there's like a 20-point swing from last time. And we all know Biden won by a sliver. So I go, what's going to bring those voters back? And the Israeli and the war is just Biden can't win either way. He can't win either way. Yeah. He can't win either way.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because I'm very afraid that Trump is going to win. And I do think if it were today, he would win as well. And I worry that a lot of folks in the media maybe aren't honest enough with the public about just how real that possibility is. And the danger, it used to be the power of the incumbency, but I think now the danger of the incumbency is any bad thing that happens going forward is only going to make things harder for Joe Biden.
Yes.
I agree with you. It's a lose-lose on Gaza, because he knows where his left flank is. He knows where young people are. But you're not going to get the Nikki Haley's, the independents, the moderates if you end up looking like you're distancing yourself from Israel.
I'm seeing, by the way, I'm Jewish, obviously, and I have a lot of my friends are Jewish, and they're torn. They hate Trump, but they feel that, you know, I'm just worried about the Jewish vote. You know, I don't know, you know, it's only 2% of this country, but it's just so much. Let's get a little bit lighter. Let's talk about The View. Not that The View is light, but what I love about the group now, there used to be, as a media watcher, I would sense pre-calculated conflict. You know what I mean? Like we need that little bite in page six that, and you guys seem to have, you're new. Everybody seems to have grown up a little bit. And so that's not the formula. Obviously controversy sells, but we're not here to do that. We're here to really talk things through. And I think it's kind of one of the best versions of the show ever.
Well, I appreciate that. I think the most important thing with a show like The View is the chemistry at the table.
Yes.
Because you have to be able to go out and talk about, yeah, abortion rights being rolled back and then quick pivot to like dating or sex or something. And you've got to be able to be really comfortable with the people around you. And for me, I have felt, I went into this thinking like Joy Behar, she's got to be so mean and she's, you know, so progressive and we'll never get along. She respects my viewpoint and I respect hers. We may never agree on certain issues, but that's the idea. There's a mutual respect and there's an idea that I think it helps with me that I don't feel the need to defend everything Republicans do. Yes. I can explain the way voters feel, but I'm
the same way with Democrats. I'm the same way with Democrats. I mean, I'll call it as I see it. I mean, that's it.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I also just think as a women's led show, we're so important in this moment, whether it's taking on Trump, whether it's talking about the issue of abortion, the ratings have been great. I think people like the chemistry. They want to believe that we actually enjoy each other off air. And I think
you're an important part of that because it's traditionally the more conservative voice was the shrill voice, and it was this, and I think that you guys have set a great example. What I was fascinated about in reading up on you is that you said that you run it, how many politicians watch the show? You think daytime, and it's, you know, people in power, and they work, and like how, what a show of record it really is.
It's so funny. I mean, it used to be on in like the quads in the White House. You know, you'd have MS, you'd have CNN, you'd have Fox, and then you'd have The View on when it was on. I constantly get texts from governors, house members, like, did you see this? And a lot of times it'll be also that they see the clips afterward, but it gets watched, it gets noticed. And it's from a political standpoint, we are basically like exactly who politicians on either side want to target our audience because we're right, left and center. People think our audience skews more left than it does. It's pretty middle of America, but it's young middle, people, it's women. We're reaching, you know, as many as 3 million people a day. So it's a good place for politicians to come. I'm hoping President Biden, I think Biden will come on before the election.
I think he should. He's got to get out there. I mean, if he stumbles, but he's got to be out there. And the irony that nobody's talking about is that Trump's not out there. You know, Trump's living at Mar-a-Lago and people don't understand it. Mar-a-Lago, he's living in a 2-bedroom corporate apartment. That's his life.
Correct.
And he comes down every day to the dining room. They put the ropes out. People stand up. They applaud. He lives in this.
It's not real life.
It's a surreal bubble that is built for him, gold gilded, and an ongoing applause whenever you show up anywhere. And people just in the most referential, fearless leader. It's actually lunacy.
It's such a good point because I visit my in-laws at their country club in Florida, which is nothing like Mar-a-Lago. But even after a few days there, I'm like, this is amazing, but it's not real life. Like you're so detached from actual reality. And how many of these voters and, you know, donors to him, small dollar donors, he just takes for a ride. Like they think he's speaking for them. They think he cares about them.
It's amazing.
And he does not respect them.
So CNN, you've got an important role there. CNN has been through a lot of trials and tribulations. Give me the latest temperature check on CNN.
So I feel like it's in a good place. People are really happy about Mark Thompson. I think having
I hear good things about him.
It's the journalism background. At the end of the day, CNN's, you know, the cream of the crop in journalism. That is what is our lifeblood. Business matters, views matter, but being world-class journalists is the most important thing.
Yes.
So I think there was this sense of like, he's one of us. He comes from our world. I'm really proud of like the lineup. Caitlin Collins has been a friend of mine since we were like in our early 20s in DC. And she's managed to like, she is constantly making news. Her interviews are like cutthroat. She holds everyone's feet to the fire. Listen, CNN's dealing with what every cable and eventually network is going to deal with, which
legacy,
is this move to streaming.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is tough to navigate. It's hard to see. And for me, I get frustrated because I want more people watching real news where there's factual standards and you have to correct yourself. But I think it's in the best place it's been in years.
So
we're on the up and up.
We're on the up. No, it feels like it's going on. And you said there's a lot of talent there. I actually have Fareed on the show tomorrow.
Nice.
So it's, you know, you guys are doing great. So give me your, before I let you go, give me your next 6 months prediction of how things going to, I'm not saying that we've already talked about how we feel about the election, but where do you see the world the next 6 months? I've never, and I'm substantially older than you, I've never felt more agita than I feel now for this country and the world for a whole host of reasons. I'm still optimistic and I just wonder how you're feeling.
I think it's a really uncertain and unpredictable time. I, like you, think that we are going to see a number of unexpected things happen in American life in the lead up to the election, in politics and elsewhere. But I believe that there are going to be situations that happen that were like, we should have seen that coming, but didn't. And I'm not even, and I know this sounds crazy, I'm not even completely convinced that there won't be changes made if necessary at some point.
By the way, I'm not saying that out loud. I completely agree with you. I could see
people get furious. I say this to someone, by the way, who wants Joe Biden to win, but there, it's not out of the realm of possibility.
I could see if we are heading to the convention and he's down 20 points.
Yeah.
I could see I'm not saying it on MSNBC because they'll carry me out, but I mean, right. I hear what you're saying.
But unpredictable in general. And I think also Trump trials, we still don't have a locked in timeline on what's going to happen. The only one that matters to Republican voters, or I think would really shift the election, is January 6th.
They don't care about, they don't even care about the documents because they're like, all right, they both took documents. They certainly don't care about the hush money. Georgia case is a close second, but yes, January 6th, but that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen for years,
I think the ruling on immunity and how quickly that moves can affect things. But basically I'd say be ready for turbulence. And I do think voters are going to wake up in the final, like, not even 3 months, like 30 days to like, oh, wow, we might be doing Trump again. And that's when you'll start to see a little bit of eyes opening. World stage, I'm very, very worried about Ukraine. I cannot believe that my Republican Party is responsible for potentially letting Russia win this war. It's devastating. The world needs to keep their eyes on it. They're losing territory.
He ain't going to stop there.
We have 10,000 troops in Poland. We can't let this happen.
Melissa Farah Griffin, what a pleasure it is to talk to you. Continued success. I'm watching you ascend, and good things happen to good people. So I'm so happy for you.
Thank you, Donnie. It was a pleasure to be on.